It's worth noting here that Klaus Barbie was not only a veteran U.S. intelligence agent and Galen agent, but he also, in certain places and times, has in fact worked with members of the secret team. Reading now from the San Francisco Examiner of Thursday, May 21st of 1987, is an article by Paul Heath Heffel, H-O-E-F-F-E-L, Newsweek International, datelined Buenos Aires, headlined Barbie's Second Life in Bolivia. Subheaded, New Book Says Nazi Returned to Violence While in Latin America. As the wartime activities of Klaus Barbie are scrutinized in a French courtroom, a chilling account of the Gestapo chief's second life, his 32 years as businessman Klaus Altmann in Bolivia, was published last week in Buenos Aires. Barbie, A Criminal to the End, by Gustavo Sanchez, a former Bolivian government official, suggests that the Nazi's Latin American incarnation was little improvement over his first. Skipping down in the article, had Barbie been content to stay out of politics, he would probably have continued to work undisturbed as manager of a Jewish-owned lumber mill in northern Bolivia. But, by Sanchez's account, Barbie eventually hooked up with a network of powerful right-wing army officers on the rise. By 1967, he was working secretly as a counterinsurgency advisor to the army, playing a role in the capture and execution of Che Guevara, the Argentine-born guerrilla leader, as we're going to see, a key member of the secret team, namely Felix Rodriguez, a.k.a. Max Gomez, was one of Barbie's cohorts in the Guevara hunt, in the hunt for Che Guevara.
That's right. We're going to read a little bit about him here from an article in the San Jose Mercury News for Friday, October 17, 1986. The article's headline, Controversy, Exposes Exploits of Secret Soldier. Boy, they were really into alliterations when they wrote that headline. Anyway, the article is by Doyle McManus and William R. Long of the Los Angeles Times, and they're talking about, as Dave mentioned, Felix Rodriguez, known more recently as Max Gomez, but that's only one of his many pseudonyms. Felix Rodriguez is the closest thing to a real name the man has. That was his name at birth. Rodriguez was involved in the hunt for Che Guevara, and we're going to read a little bit about that right now. In 1967 came the undisputed high point of Rodriguez's career, the capture of Che Guevara. Guevara, an Argentine theorist who was sent abroad by Castro as his apostle of revolution, was in Bolivia trying to start a rural guerrilla movement. A Bolivian Army Ranger team advised by the CIA caught up with him in October 1967. Several former CIA officers and friends of Rodriguez said that the CIA advisors wanted to keep Guevara alive for further interrogation, but Bolivian officials ordered his execution. Before he died, Rodriguez has told friends, Guevara handed him his watch, the watch the former CIA man still wears. In the late 1960s, the CIA was swiftly expanding its operations in support of the war in Vietnam, and Felix Rodriguez went along. Quote, he was down in the Mekong Delta, a CIA veteran said. He was a self-taught helicopter pilot. He did some very brave things. He was shot down twice by enemy ground fire, Basulto recalled, as is another person talking about Rodriguez. As a result of the last crash, most of the vertebrae in Rodriguez's back were fused, and he reluctantly returned from the war. In about 1975, he retired from the CIA with full medical disability pay. But Rodriguez left the CIA with a host of key contacts around the world and in Washington, where his friends included Theodore Shackley, a former deputy director of the agency, and Donald Gregg, now the national security advisor to Vice President Bush, himself a former director of the CIA. And, of course, Felix Rodriguez later went on, among other things, to be the head of the covert weapons shipments out of the Ilopango Air Force Base, including the plane that happened to be flown, traveled in by Eugene Hassenfuss, and this is what Hassenfuss naming Max Gomez as head of the operation and Max Gomez being revealed as Felix Rodriguez is what brought Rodriguez to national prominence and has been one of the things that has cast some suspicion on good old George Bush as to his place in this whole thing. However, some of the other people who managed to do that didn't manage to stick around long enough to testify. But again, Rodriguez's antecedents going back to, among other things, the original the Bay of Pigs folks. He came out of, he was in Brigade 2506, Cuban, anti-Castro Cubans, and was involved again, as we mentioned, with Klaus Barbie in the tracking down of Che Guevara. And I somehow find it difficult to believe that Che Guevara handed him his wristwatch. That sounds like a somewhat apocryphal little detail.
So it doesn't sound like say under what conditions.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It doesn't say that Guevara's hand was still attached to his wrist. When,
yeah. At any rate, the point here being that Klaus Barbie is of the same milieu as this same group, Felix Rodriguez at least having worked directly with him before. And again, it should be borne in mind that one of the major elements, one of the major devices for funding the Contra Supply Network was cocaine smuggling, something obviously Klaus Barbie, as we looked at in a number of programs, was heavily involved in for a long period of time. Now, again, hearkening back to one of the things which has brought up this line of discussion, namely the North association with Mansour al-Qassar, and in turn, al-Qassar's sponsorship of terrorists such as Abu Abbas, the mastermind of the Achille Lauro hijacking, and Abu Nidal. Bear that in mind, because one of the aspects of the Achille Lauro hijacking that emerged, or that didn't emerge when the incident took place. By the way, the Achille Lauro was an Italian cruise ship which was hijacked, and an American Jew named Leon Klinghoffer was murdered during the course of that hijacking. This is one of a number of terrorist incidents in calendar year 1985, which arrested American political awareness to a considerable extent. Interestingly enough, one of the demands of the Achille Lauro hijackers was that a prominent German neo-Nazi named Ottfried Hepp was one of the people to be released and turned over to them. And this, again, would come as something of a surprise to a lot of people in light of the fact that Ottfried Hepp obviously was a neo-Nazi. The ostensible political sentiments of people like Abu Abbas would appear to be more left-wing. One of the things that we took a look at in a supplement to Radio Free America number 22 in particular is the growing habit on the part of fascist and explicitly Nazi elements around the world of adopting what's known as the third position, namely an attempt to incorporate certain features of progressive political philosophy, mostly superficial ones, in order to attract disaffected people from the more progressive side of the political spectrum to their own cause. This is not at all unprecedented in the history of fascism. The original German Nazi Party, in its inception, had a, quote, radical, unquote, wing, a radical left wing, headed by a man named Gregor Strasser. Most of these people were former disenchanted Marxists who still sought to, quote, overthrow bourgeois society, unquote. It's just that they did not believe in Marxism. Hitler very cleverly was able to utilize these people as street fighters until he assumed power, at which point Gregor Strasser and the others were then promptly liquidated, and which just goes to show that sometimes what goes around comes around. At any rate, again, the politics of the third position are worth taking note of in the context of the association of people like Oliver North with the likes of Mansour al-Qassar. And as to what exactly people like al-Qassar or Abu Abbas or Abu Nidal actually think, what goes through their mind, through their consciousness, I don't think myself or Nip would attempt to say. They may be sincere fanatics who don't realize how destructive that type of terrorism is to the cause that they pretend to represent, or they may, in fact, be deep cover agent provocateur, someone deliberately setting this up. It is our belief that the association of people like Oliver North and members of the secret team with people like that is to manipulate them for strategic ends. Obviously, terrorism is a major rallying cry of the American far right and the far right all over the world. And again, it's worth taking note of here that one of the people that the hijackers of the Achille Lauro wanted turned over to them was a prominent German neo-Nazi named Ottfried Hepp. A good account of this is carried in an excellent article in the May issue of Mother Jones for this year, namely May of 1987. It's an article called Killers on the Right, subheaded Inside Europe's Fascist Underground. It's co-authored by Martin Lee and Kevin Coogan, both of whose work we featured on these broadcasts in the past. And in this article, they describe the request by the Achille Lauro hijackers to get a hold of Ottfried Hepp, and they describe Ottfried Hepp's background. Again, from Mother Jones, May of 1987. Let's see, I forgot the title offhand. Anyway, Killers of the New... Well, let me reread the title here, as long as we're doing it. Killers on the Right, Inside Europe's Fascist Underground. Among the hardliners in the Arab camp is the Palestine Liberation Front, PLF, a Tunis-based organization headed by Mohammed Abu Abbas. Abbas is best known for masterminding the Achille Lauro hijacking in 1985, much to the embarrassment of Yasser Arafat. Although news of the Achille Lauro incident was splashed widely across U.S. newspapers and beamed nightly via television into U.S. living rooms, the major U.S. news media never reported an intriguing part of the story. Included on the PLF's list of prisoners to be exchanged for the Achille Lauro hostages was the name of Ottfried Hepp, O-D-F-R-I-E-D-H-E-P-P, then one of West Germany's most wanted neo-Nazi terrorists. "I know Hepp quite well," Abbas told the French Daily Libération in 1985. He is a friend. I do not consider him to be a Nazi. On the contrary, he is a militant, anti-imperialist and anti-Zionist, and a supporter of the Palestinian cause, unquote. The 28-year-old Hep was arrested in Paris on April 8, 1985, while entering an apartment inhabited by a leading member of the PLF. He was convicted of possessing weapons and false identification papers, and was extradited earlier this year to West Germany, where he has been charged with organizing a series of bombings against U.S. military bases. Let me read that last sentence again. He was convicted of possessing weapons and false identification papers, and was extradited earlier this year to West Germany, where he has been charged with organizing a series of bombings against U.S. military bases. Hep's saga as a terrorist began in the late 1970s when he underwent paramilitary training with the neo-Nazi Hoffmann Group at a castle near Nuremberg. The Hoffmann Group, which had participated in joint maneuvers with neo-Nazis from several European countries, was banned after police raided the castle in February of 1980 and seized a huge cache of explosives, automatic weapons, uniforms, poisonous chemicals, anti-aircraft guns, and a tank, all supplied by sympathizers inside the West German army. Later that year, a Hoffmann graduate blew himself up while planning a bomb at Munich's Oktoberfest celebration. A final body count of 11 dead and 200 injured made it the worst terrorist incident in post-war Germany. Hep was briefly imprisoned in 1981 for distributing Nazi propaganda and inciting racial hatred. While in jail, he sent a letter to Berlin's leftist newspaper, Die Tageszeitung, bitterly denouncing the United States. Quote, "The minds and souls of people here in the West are in the process of stultification," unquote, said Hep, whose letter ended, "Forward in the anti-imperialist struggle," unquote. In a prison interview with Die Welt, he added, "We think everyone is justified in this struggle. We only have a chance if the leftists and rightists come together," unquote.
Continuing. Not long after Hep was released from prison, other neo-Nazi cadres began attacking NATO installations and discotheques that catered to American servicemen. Two GIs and an Egyptian national were killed in June 1982 when a neo-Nazi gunman burst into a Nuremberg disco and opened fire on the crowd. Hep led a gang that unleashed a spate of terror bombings in late 1982 at four U.S. Army bases in West Germany, Eschborn, Darmstadt, Butzbach, and Fessenheim. Initially, it was widely assumed by press and government officials that left-wing terrorists, either the Red Army faction or the revolutionary cells, were behind the bombings. But a police investigation showed otherwise. In February 1983, three of Hep's Kameraden were arrested in Frankfurt. According to RAND Corporation analyst Bruce Hoffman, by this time Hep had escaped to England, where he was safe-housed by British Nazis. From there, he traveled to Damascus and the Syrian-controlled Bekaa Valley in Lebanon. During this period, according to the French magazine Le Point, Hep worked with George Habash's Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. His next stop was Tunis, where he earned a salary of $500 a month working for the Abu Abbas Group. And then, in 1984, he surfaced in France. For the better part of a year, Hep circulated among the international terrorist underground in Paris. While in Paris, he had contacts not only with Arab terrorists and neo-Nazi fugitives, but also with indigenous left-wing organizations such as Direct Action, the Belgian-based Communist Combatant Cells, and West Germany's Red Army faction. This far-left trio issued a joint communique in January 1985 announcing the formation of a united, quote, political military front, unquote, to wage revolutionary war in Europe, with NATO as its principal target. According to Bruce Hoffman, Hep is suspected of having participated in the 1984 bombing of the Rhein-Main Air Force Base, a U.S. installation in Frankfurt, West Germany. Two U.S. servicemen were wounded in the attack, which has been attributed by the German press to leftists. He is also a suspect in the 1985 bombings of the Marks and Spencer department store in Paris and the Cinéma Rivoli Beaubourg, where a Jewish film festival was being shown. Responsibility for the later attack was claimed by Direct Action. Apparently, Direct Action and its left-wing partners did not fear being manipulated by the likes of Otfried Hep. Again, a very important series of connections here, and a very important, more important than just the actual individual connections, is the pattern established. We talked about the fact that during the trial of Klaus Barbie, that Klaus Barbie was being himself defended by a lawyer by the name of Jacques Vergès. Jacques Vergès, prominent in France for being a pro-Algerian, pro-Arab liberation lawyer with clients on the far left and the far right, and apparently himself one of the focal points of contacts between the far left and the far right. Here we see Odfried Hepp, a man himself a neo-Nazi, coming into contact with groups like Direct Action and the communist combatant cells of Belgium and things like that, and also with a variety of ostensibly left-wing Arab organizations putting together something that can only be called provocative terrorist attacks against American military bases.
Again, a couple of Radio Free America references. Radio Free America number 22, we went into the geniture of Arab terrorism, the Galen connections, and in an addendum to Radio Free America number 22, from the book Unhealed Wounds by Erna Paris, a current book and an excellent one, incidentally, current at least ways as of September of 1987, we went into the Jacques Vergès connections and his connections with a lot of these same elements.
Indeed. And all right, continue. Should we continue here? Should we take a break?
I think it's a good place to take a break because we're about to jump from the Achille Lauro and the, well, we might want to have a little bit more interpolative discussion, but next we're gonna stop. Next stop is Italy, although the subject matter is going to be regrettably the same.
Well, one of the interesting things here, and one of the ways in which the interpolative matter with Italy is very similar, is we discussed earlier in this broadcast the strategy of tension, and one of the things that we talked about, and I believe it was an Italian intelligence recruit who had been, was talking about the fact that when he came into the organization, into the SISMI,
basically, he was interviewed by a guy named Pietro Musumeci, one of the members of the P2, and also something called the Super SISMI.
That's right, Super SISMI, and Musumeci asked this recruit to the Italian intelligence forces, well, we're going to put you out in the field, do you want to be part of a left-wing group or a right-wing group? He opted for the right-wing group, but the clear inference, not even the inference, but the direct comment that this person was making was that both the right-wing and the left-wing groups were being manipulated by Italian intelligence. Of course, as we've seen in many cases, the right-wing terrorist groups in Italy were virtually inseparable from intelligence itself. A lot of these people were, the Italian intelligence officials, especially in the Super SISMI, were virtually terrorists themselves.
Nor is this new. As we looked at in Radio Free America number 10, the Nazi Party itself in its inception was a front for German military intelligence under the political department of General von Lassau. So this is not at all unprecedented. It's one of the reasons why we focus so much on the intelligence services. A lot of people, at least ways up until the recent Iran-Contra scandal, tend to view that as sort of a nitpicky kind of a thing.
Now, when we look at the fact that European intelligence, especially the right-wing branches of European intelligence, are in fact owning, setting up, manipulating, creating left-wing organizations to cause provocative terrorism, most notably Arab left-wing organizations, to cause provocative terrorist activities to further their own political position. And then when we find out that Oliver North and his band of gypsies seems to be intimately connected with a variety of groups themselves connected to various left-wing groups, but even more intimately connected to people like Muammar Gaddafi, Mansour al-Qassar, and through him, Abu Nidal and Abu Abbas, the pattern is clear, folks. It's only a question of adding two and two together and coming up with a requisite four.
And it should be noted, too, I think, the comment of Lee and Coogan in that article, that many of the terrorist acts by Odfried Hepp and Direct Action were initially attributed in the American press to the work of, quote, leftists, unquote. And obviously, that sort of reactive pattern is exactly what we find inherent in the plans for Rex 84.
That's right. While you're thinking about all that, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll be talking more. We're going to be updating the idea of how Rex 84 might have worked out or might still work out. And we're going to talk a little bit more about the terrorist connections and the unfolding of the provocateur underground when we return with more of Radio Free America. And Dave Emery and myself, Nip Tuck, right here. Secret team with a variety of other operatives, including a lot of right-wing fringe groups and a lot of right-wing mainstream groups who themselves are manipulating left-wing and Arab liberationist terror groups for the purpose of forwarding their own political agendas, notably fascist political agendas. And in this last segment of the broadcast, we're going to talk a little bit about a case that is just now coming to light, a case that looks to provide hours of fun and entertainment for One Step Beyond and Radio Free America listeners, cropping up in Italy and apparently looking quite likely to intersect with a variety of other things we've been talking about tonight in other broadcasts.
One of the things that we have, one of the points we've been making over the years, well, not over the years, over the months since the Iran-Contra scandal broke, is that it appeared to be direct and ongoing connections between the secret team and the attempt on the life of Pope John Paul II in May of 1981. We did a five-part Radio Free America series about that. That is the aforementioned Mediterranean merry-go-round series, Radio Free America show 17 through 21. Among the many points that we made was that an arms-for-drug smuggling ring called STEBOM, with a massive intersection with U.S. intelligence, was one of the central elements involved in the shooting of Pope John Paul II. It also was involved in shipping arms to both the Contras and to Khomeini in Iran for the war with Iraq. That obviously is very reminiscent of the Iran arms scandal, the Contra supply effort, and due to some excellent translations that have been provided to us from the Italian press by one of our listeners, we have been able to trace some other very, very hard connections between arms smuggling in Italy and the Iran-Contra scandal. And in fact, just this past week, a story broke which appears to cement the ostensibly two Iran arms scandals. It appears now that they are really one, and they are two parts of the same thing. We are going to talk about the Italian Irangate, as it's being dubbed, which just emerged this past week. And then we're going to go and deal with some of the Italian translations provided to us by our listener. Reading from the San Francisco Chronicle of Wednesday, September 9th of 1987. This is a Chronicle Wire Service story, Dateline Rome, and headlined, Italy has Iran arms scandal. Investigating magistrates say they have broken up an illegal international arms ring that delivered Italian mines to Iran and involved Middle East terrorists, Syrian agents, Sicilian mafiosi, and European middlemen. At least 34 people, including Italian industrialist Ferdinando Borletti, B-O-R-L-E-T-T-I, have been arrested in the past few days in what Italy's press is calling Italy's Irangate scandal, unquote. No government officials were implicated. I would interrupt, that might perhaps be yet, as that our information indicates otherwise. In the latest arrest, Aldo Anghesa, A-N-G-H-E-S-S-A, a mysterious arms trader who left a briefcase full of incriminating documents in a hotel room, turned himself into police yesterday. 11 people are still being sought. Rome's La Repubblica newspaper said on Monday that the dealings also involved a plot to assassinate President Reagan in Venice last June by shooting down his helicopter. Let me reread that last sentence. Rome's La Repubblica newspaper said on Monday that the dealings also involved a plot to assassinate President Reagan in Venice last June by shooting down his helicopter. There was no official confirmation of that, but authorities say the case will have wide repercussions throughout Europe. Our work is only beginning, Prosecutor Augusto Lama said. We are investigating along several directions. We will turn half of Europe upside down. Lama and other investigating magistrates said the operation involved delivery of mines from Italy to Iran by way of Syria and shipping drugs and weapons to Italy for use by the mafia and Middle Eastern terrorists. Italy bans military sales to Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Libya. When the Italian Navy arrives in the Persian Gulf, the mines it will try to sweep out of the way of Italian ships most likely were manufactured in Italy and illegally supplied to Iran. Prime Minister Giovanni Goria's government is bracing for a parliamentary debate this week on its decision to send a minesweeping force to the Persian Gulf. The naval operation is expected to begin in about a month. Details began emerging last week after the Lebanese cargo ship Bustani I was seized off Bari in southern Italy. Police said it was carrying U.S.-made anti-aircraft missiles, Soviet-made grenade launchers, bazookas, and 4.4 pounds of heroin and 33 pounds of hashish. All 17 people aboard, including the Lebanese captain, were arrested. The magistrates said the arms apparently were destined for Middle East terrorist groups operating in Italy and elsewhere in Europe. Lama said the terrorists are believed linked to Palestinian extremist Abu Nidal, accused of masterminding the attacks on the Rome and Vienna airports in December of 1985. Lama said two reputed mafia figures from Trapani, Sicily, Felice Corrao and Guido Coduri, were among those arrested last weekend. He said the mafia was involved in selling drugs, some of whose profits were used to buy more arms as well as to swell the coffers of both the mob and the terrorists. Industrialist Borletti, 65, and his 33-year-old son Giovanni were both charged with violations of arms laws. Borletti is the chairman of Valsella Meccanotanica, an arms manufacturer outside Brescia near Milan, and is also a board member of Fiat and of the business daily Il Sole, 24 Ore. His son is director general of the arms company. The arrest warrants name two Greek ship owners who allegedly provided the Bustani I and other ships for the traffickers. Two Syrian Secret Service agents are also among those named. La Repubblica ran a front-page editorial Sunday headlined, Our Iran Gate, saying, If the accusations of the magistrates are confirmed, it will be a scandal without precedent. Well, when we began talking about the shooting of Pope John Paul II, we began talking about the Stibom Arms for Drugs ring. One of its masterminds, Bekir Çelenk, has been named as the alleged paymaster for Mehmet Ali Aja and the other Turkish neo-Nazis involved in the plot. It's also worth noting that a Syrian national named Henry Arsan, himself an agent for the Drug Enforcement Agency, ran this Arms for Drugs ring. Among the many people involved with it were a former National Security Agency agent named Glauco Partel, and also a man named Eugene Bartholomaeus, not only an intimate of Edwin Wilson's and a partner in his Libyan ventures, but also a person who dealt with the Nugenhand Bank. Here again we find a Syrian-based arms for drugs ring, which is very mindful not only of Manzer el-Kassar, who was Syrian also, but also of Henry Arsan and Stibom. And one of the two of the things to focus on in this article, and we're going to flesh out our understanding of the Italian-Iran gate and how it really appears to be part of ours in just a second, take note of the fact that, first of all, these extremists and terrorists were linked with Abu Nidal, the same Abu Nidal who was linked with Manzer el-Kassar, and who also, as we're going to see, has been linked with not only an Italian arms dealer named Adnan Roussan, last name R-O-U-S-A-N, but also with another Adnan Khashoggi, the Saudi Arabian arms dealer who is one of the principals in the Iran-Contra scandal. Also take note of the fact that these terrorists were going to, among the things they were planning, was to assassinate President Reagan by shooting down his helicopter. This should be reflected on against the background of Rex 84 and the martial law plans. That certainly would have served as a very good pretext had this coup group basically wanted to get their plan into effect.
Now, the purported plan to shoot down President Reagan's helicopter in Venice in June of 1986 was not the first time that allegations had been made that people or that enemies of America were planning to assassinate the president. We're going to get to some earlier allegations of that sort in just a moment, but right now we're going to discuss another apparent threat or the intimation of a threat to the life of the president from around the same time as the terrorists supposedly were going to shoot him down over Venice. This is an article from In These Times, provided by Mae Brussel. It's the It's In These Times, August of 1987, and the article is headlined, CIA Agent's Lawyer Moves for Secrecy in Christic Institute Suit. The article is by Dennis Bernstein, Richard Ryan, and Peter Schinkel, Dateline Washington, D.C. And what they're talking about here is Glenn Robinette, former CIA officer and contact of Secord and the man who was also asked to build the security system for Oliver North. And Glenn Robinette was asked at one point in the summer of 1986 to have a conversation with Oliver North about an upcoming conversation that the FBI was going to have with a man by the name of Jack Terrell, a former Contra supporter.
Now, Jack Terrell was a person who was involved with the Contra supply effort. He later turned, lack of a better term, state's evidence. He is now one of the informants for the Christic Institute's suit.
Now, talking about this Jack Terrell and Jack Terrell's interrogation of the FBI, it says, a July 22, 1986 FBI report outlines a discussion between North, that's Oliver North, of course, and two FBI agents about the former Contra, Terrell, although it does not explain the FBI's reason for investigating Terrell. The same two agents interrogated Terrell in August of 1986, ostensibly about a threat on the life of the president in July of last year. The article goes on to mention that Terrell says that during 12 hours of questioning and 2 days of polygraphing, they never actually asked him one question about a threat on the life of Ronald Reagan. But it's interesting. On one hand, we have supposedly this Syrian-based arms-dealing group, very similar to another prominent fascist-linked arms group who are supposedly going to shoot down Ronald Reagan in June. Then in July, a former Contra supporter turned Christic Institute witness is dragged in by the FBI after the FBI has talked to Oliver North's man, Glenn Robinette, and dragged in and interrogated about a supposed attempt on the plot on the president. And Robinette and Terrell, rather, says nobody actually asked him any questions, but that he thought it was an attempt to intimidate him. So perhaps something interesting being planned there, and the attempt to shoot down the helicopter fell through, and what was left over was used as an excuse to intimidate Jack Terrell from talking to the Christic Institute.
Now, as we mentioned, a very excellent and diligent listener has been doing terrific work in researching and translating the Italian press for us. He has been developing a number of intriguing relationships in these translations between a couple of people. First of all, the two of the main names to understand here are Adnan Roussan, last name R-O-U-S-A-N, and Adnan Khashoggi, the Saudi Arabian arms dealer so central to the Iran-Contra scandal. Now, Adnan Roussan and Adnan Khashoggi are closely related. They also are closely related. They apparently have connections with a man named Peter Alley, A-L-E-Y, a Reagan aide, who apparently worked with both men. They also have connections with many of Europe's and the Middle East's top terrorists, including Abu Nidal, including the people possibly implicated in the LaBelle discotheque bombing in Berlin, which was used as an excuse to attack Gaddafi, also in a couple of attempted bombings. And we're going to begin examining now again Adnan Roussan as an arms dealer who admits, quite frankly, that he was used by the United States to ship arms to Khomeini. He also was affiliated with a lot of different people, including Abu Nidal. Recall the Manzar El-Kassar link to both North and Abu Nidal, and their links to the Achille Lauro hijacking as well. And again, we're going to begin looking at these translations now and examining the many different notorious terrorists who appear to be connected up with the Iran-Contra effort. And again, the question we're asking is, were these people being deliberately manipulated in order to, in essence, get the Rex 84 plan at least ready, if not actually in effect? And bear in mind what the public reaction might have been had terrorists assassinated Ronald Reagan. These same terrorist groups, as we're going to see, have close associations with many players in the Iran-Contra scandal, including Adnan Khashoggi and, as we've seen, Oliver North. Research credit and translation credit for this goes to that very same listener. His first name is Dave, by the way. I'm not going to credit him with his both names for obvious reasons, but he deserves the credit. He's done excellent work. This is from La Repubblica of January 25th, 1987. And again, the key names, Adnan Roussan, Adnan Khashoggi, Abu Nidal, Peter Alley. To have in common not only the names, they are both called Adnan, but to also know each other is something more than an onomastic coincidence. Adnan Roussan, the 40-year-old Jordanian arrested in Verona last summer, and Adnan Khashoggi, the billionaire financier at the center of the Iran affair. For years in Italy, Roussan formerly looked after a textile trading company. There would be orders placed by his Verona base, arms of every kind shuttled to numerous countries, nearly all engaged in border war, Middle Eastern ones including Syria and Iran. Is it possible that nobody suspected him? Roussan maintains that he informed the government in exact detail of every transaction of this type, and therefore considered himself authorized, unquote. But he was also in contact with a police officer in Verona, a circumstance that, he adds, almost made him consider calling it quits with the Italian authorities. How much truth is there in his clearly defensive story? Investigators looking into the activities of the Jordanian revolutionary movement are checking. Certainly some elements call into question the point of authorization. Roussan, in fact, was initially accredited in international political circles as an influential representative of the PLO. His entree somehow enabled him to set up a solid and well-camouflaged base in Italy. From here, he handled relations with members of numerous secret services, sometimes authorizing them to supervise arms transactions.
Continuing. In Roussan's notebook was the telephone number of Peter Alley, A-L-E-Y, a prominent personality in the White House establishment, a telephone number that very few in Washington have, except by the express wish of President Reagan. Among the hundreds of telexes seized from Roussan were some actually addressed to Alley. The subject naturally concerned weapons. Armorer for all nations, Roussan does not deny reaching out on behalf of the USA to Khomeini. A detailed catalog of war instruments, with lots of prices and useful information signed by Alley himself, was discovered in the Jordanian's Verona home. USA and jet missiles, remote control bombs, grenade launchers, submachine guns, chemical bombs. Samples intended for other countries, not only the Middle East, but also Africa, Ethiopia, and Senegal. Even Roussan's telexes even reached Khashoggi. Several were addressed to the Nabila, the Arab financier's fabulous yacht, whose name reveals another coincidence. Roussan's company was called, in fact, Nabula Trading Limited. Investigators translating the coded telexes are convinced that a NATO officer, Roussan's guest at the time of his arrest, was there on behalf of Ali to discuss an arms deal. Also in Adnan Roussan's notebook was another important name among European traffickers, that of Gunter, a German who recently took care in France of arms sales to Syria. This is not a case of casual contact. Roussan, according to the investigators, relies directly on, quote, honorable men for his work and likes the company of, quote, leaders, including Abu Nidal, who would fly with him. Presumably meaning he would fly, that they would share a private jet together. Anyway, so rather interesting connections again between Adnan Roussan, this Jordanian arms dealer, Peter Ali, a high-ranking Reagan administration official, and contact between, and thereby being another conduit for shipping arms to yet another provocative Arab group, namely Khomeini's Iranian government.
And again, we have Adnan Roussan associated, according to that article, not only with Adnan Khashoggi, who we deal with, also with Abu Nidal, Peter Ali, and that he has admitted in so many terms, in so many words, that he in fact was selling arms to Khomeini on behalf of the United States. This is why we say that it now appears that Italy's Irangate and our Irangate are part of the same situation. And again, the contacts between Reagan White House people and Abu Nidal are as ominous as they are astounding.